Hello, welcome to Focus on Community. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and we are live on the air tonight for this month's edition of a radio program dedicated to informing Southeast Alaska K2 listeners about a myriad of psychological and social issues confronting us in our daily lives, and ultimately about living our lives with more awareness and greater happiness. Well, sometimes we say, well, that's just human nature. But let's ask the question, do all people feel and respond the same way deep down? Is there a basic communality among us that we call human nature? Do we all grieve alike? Do all societies have the same basic moral views? Are all cultures similarly altruistic or greedy? Is violence and war inevitable because they are just part of human nature? We've all heard that Westerners are more individualistic, meaning each man for himself kind of thing, than people from traditional societies or from Asia, where the group, the welfare of the whole, is more important. But just how much does this individualism set us apart from the majority of humanity? Or does it? Are we different? Are we weird compared to the rest of other societies? Well, tonight I will be joined by Gary Weglars, a mental health clinician working in Juneau with hospice as well as in private practice. I think we're going to have a very fascinating discussion tonight because Gary recently was attending a professional conference and presented a paper concerning these very questions on the ethnocentrism of Western psychology. But before we delve into the subject of tonight's show, let me welcome Gary Weglars to our program and ask him, what prompted your interest in this subject?
Well, it's been a topic that I've always been interested in. Actually, some of my early memories of growing up in blue-collar Detroit are walking down the street surrounded by concrete and grass lawns and wishing I was up north in northern Michigan where all the frogs and the natural world was, and wondering, you know, how can this be? How can these worlds be so different? So I think I've had a very long-standing interest in and how different cultures relate to the natural world in different ways, and how our culture is maybe unique in some ways.
Well, tell me about the cross-cultural research that you presented the paper on. That I think, because I did read the summation of the paper, that has turned assumptions about the universality of certain human traits upside down. So could you just give us an overview of what this is about?
Sure. I was putting together a presentation for a hospice conference to talk about working cross-culturally. And in the course of some of the web research I was doing, I came across some really interesting research that's been out for a couple of years. I think the paper was initially published in a peer-reviewed journal in 2010. And the title of the paper is WEIRD, The Weirdest People in the World. And WEIRD is an acronym for the following: white, educated, industrialized, rich, and that's rich compared to the majority of humanity, and then the D for democratic. So white, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic is a set of traits that the researchers who put this paper together were looking at as a group that they found really kind of stood out from the rest of humanity. I'll tell you a little bit about how their research began. The lead researcher, Joe Heinrich, began in the field of anthropology. He was working on his, I think, doctoral work. And one of the things that struck him was that the vast majority of research subjects in psychology and social psychology come from Western cultures, come from weird culture. And to give you an example of just how dramatic this bias is, between 2003 and 2007, subjects from Western cultures accounted for 96% of the subjects in peer-reviewed, published research, and within that 96%, 70% from the United States. Now, why might that be a problem? Well, that 96% of the research subjects make up only 12% of the world's population.
So they're all European origin people. And aren't the majority of the people who are in studies, at least when I was in college, are college students?
That's right. Usually it's second year college students in the social sciences, which the researchers actually found is kind of another subgroup that has some significant differences from people within Western societies that aren't going to college. So the big question that I think was coming to mind for the researcher Joe Heinrich was, you know, how well does our research on these subjects generalize to the world as a whole? Because this is the research that we kind of have been basing in the West our whole notion of what human nature is, you know, how the human brain functions, how we we're wired around moral issues, issues of fairness, a variety of things. And so he began his research by going to some small non-Western Aboriginal societies, and he brought in something called the ultimatum game. And the ultimatum game is
that's a very common psychology. Economics. Isn't it economics and psychology of how to try to understand what they call human nature?
That's right. The ultimatum game is something that's been used in the field of economics and psychology to explore issues of fairness and get an idea of, you know, kind of how we're wired around the idea of being fair. And so the way the game is played is the researcher has two players, and he gives one of the players, let's just use a figure, $100, and he informs that player that he can give the other player as much of that money as he wants. And if the other player accepts it, they both keep the amount. He keeps the amount that he has left, and the other player keeps the amount that he agreed to accept. So that's it. That's the gist of the ultimatum game.
And they don't know who the other player is. It's an anonymous.
Yeah, the other player is anonymous, and the other player has only one decision to make. Either they accept the amount, and in which case both players get to keep, you know, the amount that was agreed upon, or if they refuse the amount, then neither player gets anything. So that's the rules of the game. You can the second player can accept the amount, and then there's a split of some sort, or neither player gets anything. Now, in Western cultures, in these white, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic cultures, 50-50 is the way this works. This was the standard. This is exactly what Heinrich expected to find as he went into these other cultures. But what he found was that that just wasn't the case in the majority of cultures he began to research.
Yeah.
And so it gave you an example. In a number of cultures, a very small amount would be offered, much less than 50%, and people would always accept that. And asking people after the game was completed, you know, what their reasoning might be, he would hear things like, well, why would I punish someone else for having the good fortune to get this free money? So instead of that idea that unless you're fair with me, unless you give me half of this, I'm going to punish you, was this idea that even if somebody gives me a small amount, we've both somehow benefited, and that's a good thing.
And Gary, wasn't this from a small society he initially studied north of Machu Picchu? In the Amazon basin.
Yes.
So
yes.
This is a South American small indigenous population that had virtually no trading going on with the outside world. So anthropologists love this pure form of a traditional culture.
Right.
And what a different way of looking at it.
Right. And this came as a surprise. I mean, it might kind of not seem that way to our listeners, that we might be surprised by this, but again, this is a game, this ultimatum game that's been used for decades, you know, to examine issues of, like I say, of fairness. And in the West, it's a 50-50 split. That is the way it works. Now, they found other cultures who tended to be the gift-giving kinds of cultures. Mm. And what they found there was the common gift was over 50%, because it was offered as a culturally expected offer to curry favor or gain allegiance. But often, this offer of over 50% was rejected. And it was rejected because to accept it sets up a set of relationship expectations.
Well,
so it was kind of standing, the results were kind of standing, you know, our way of looking at things on its head. It was very different than the expectations.
Well, you know, I remember I've spent some time in Japan, and we were going to dinner at a Japanese family's home. And Japanese, for social occasions, when you are going out to somebody's house, you give it's called a presentation gift, and they sell them in stores. You know how, like, we bring a bottle of wine or mm-hmm. bouquet of flowers if you're in France. France, that's what you do in France. You don't bring a bottle of wine. You bring a bouquet of flowers. Here you bring a bottle of wine, generally. So anyways, they have these elaborate presentation gifts that are in boxes. For example, perfect pears all wrapped up in this beautiful box. There's a very limited number of presentation gift choices you can make. But here's the rub. If you are the host and someone brings a very extravagant presentation gift, you then incur an obligation. And so there is a sense of, no, I don't want that. And I remember being in one home where in Japan, where I admired something on the wall, and they wanted to take it down and give it to mm-hmm. me. And I was not aware that then I incurred a huge obligation to one-up them in something I would give them. So I guess this is what you call a gift-giving society. Is that it?
That's a beautiful example, I think, of just what we're talking about, a set of cultural expectations that we in the West find surprising and outside of our normal life. Another area that they examined that I think is quite interesting is they took around again a number of non-Western societies. Now, actually, this goes back to older research from the 1960s, the Mueller-Lyer optical illusion.
Yes.
This is something I'll try to describe it, because it's a very simple optical illusion. Describe it for the listeners so you can actually do this at home if you've just got a scrap of paper and a pencil or pen. And this is, you draw two straight lines parallel to each other. If you make them 2 or 3 inches in length and several inches apart and make them exactly the same length on the line on the left-hand side, put a set of, like, arrowheads pointing down at one end of the line, pointing up at the other. On the other line, next to it, to the right, feather those ends out. So it's like the feathered end of an arrow pointing down and pointing up. Now, that's it. This is the optical illusion, very, very, very simple optical illusion.
Mm-hmm.
A very interesting thing about this, what was discovered was that more than a dozen cultures were tested on this, and we in the United States were tended to see the optical illusion, tended to be taken in by the optical illusion and see the lines as a different length more than any of the other cultures. And
even European cultures?
I think most of this was a comparison of the United States to more Aboriginal and Native cultures around the world.
Okay.
It wasn't part of the actual weird research. They were kind of going back and
okay.
pulling in some research that had some relevance to what they were doing. And what they discovered was that where you grew up determined how you saw the illusion. And so, for example, foraging societies in the Kalahari accurately saw the lines as equal in length, while we in America did not. And the researchers...
They were smarter.
Well, the researchers speculated that because, I mean, that's it. It's an optical illusion. We know that we're being tricked, but still our eyes tell us they're a different length. And what the researchers speculate is that those of us who grew up in society in which we are raised in boxes and rectangles rather than outside in the natural world, we're the ones that are subject to these optical illusions. We're surrounded by carpentered corners, as the phrase for this goes.
Ah.
And the more a child is exposed to that and grows up in that environment, the more susceptible they are to seeing that optical illusion. Now, to me, that's a very fascinating idea, our perceptual apparatus, how we actually perceive the world, is being shaped by cultural experiences.
Wow. And I'm just thinking a little outside the carpentered corners here, outside the box. And I'm thinking about Discovery Southeast, that in Juneau is opening up children's lives to the natural world. Not to mention just living in Juneau, you open up your eyes to the natural world. And working class Detroit, I grew up in working class neighborhood in on the south side of Chicago, so we have a lot in common there. I never saw trees and flowers, and actually there was a vacant lot on our block at that time that was our world of nature, a bunch of weeds in a vacant lot. But maybe if you grow up in the natural world, you are more likely to treasure it and to want to save it and to not want to exploit it for immediate financial gain. And I'm just thinking of all the work you've done with Native Americans, because you were a clinician at Search, weren't you?
At Search, and I've spent time in Barrow and also in a couple of Aleutic villages across from Homer. So I've been really lucky to be able to spend time in Native Alaska, which has really deepened my appreciation of cultural differences, and deepened the appreciation of what we face, you know, as a population here in Alaska, where we have some huge cultural barriers. And I think this research, you know, offers us some ways to look into that in a deeper way. One of the things that came out of this is we found that there were tremendous differences in a wide range of things between Western cultures, 12% of the Earth's population, and the other 88% of the population. Differences around fairness, around cooperation, things like spatial reasoning and like the optical illusions, the way we infer the motivation of other people, self-concept, moral reasoning, the boundaries between self and other, you know, individuality versus group. And the thing that they found over and over as they started compiling research was that, again and again, there was one group of people that appeared to be tremendously unusual compared to the rest of the world's population, and that was people in the Western cultures. But there was another group, a subgroup of that, who tended to be the most unusual compared to the rest of the Western cultures, and you can guess who that is. We here in the United States, we were actually, the quote was, American participants are exceptional even within the unusual population of Westerners, outliers among outliers.
Well, you know, this is a bit of a joke, but since American exceptionalism, which has been the foundation of our international forays to occupy various countries, that we're exceptional, we can do whatever we want, may have a strong basis in culture. And Gary, you know what that really reminds me of? De Tocqueville, when he came to the United States, what he wrote about in a book called Democracy, and this is just when the U.S. was a very new country, and this French dignitary came over, and he described American individualism as, quote, a calm and considered feeling which disposes each citizen to isolate himself from the mass of his fellows and withdraw into the circle of family and friends. With this little society formed to his taste, he gladly leaves the greater society to look after itself. And so, I mean, if you think about it, how early on this unique sense of every man for himself. And I think the reasons de Tocqueville gives for considering individualism to be, and he does think it's a misguided judgment, that both politically and ethically, what he witnessed was the American frontier. There, you know, maybe geographical reasons why Americans became so individualistic, economically perhaps to their benefit, but morally. And the effect of individualism on morals seems worth considering, since there does seem to be a great difference in between America and other rich industrialized countries. For example, we're the only country that doesn't have of rich industrialized countries that doesn't have healthcare for all.
Yeah.
So we've traded a positive understanding of. Have we traded a positive understanding of social responsibility for this supposed individual gain? He also wrote this, and this is really good. This is de Tocqueville, a quote. "I see an innumerable multitude of men," he's speaking of America, "alike and equal, constantly circling around in pursuit of the petty and banal pleasures with which they glut their souls. Each of them, withdrawn into himself, is almost unaware of the fate of the rest. Mankind, for him, consists of his children and his personal friends. As for the rest of his fellow citizens, they are near enough, but he does not notice them. He touches them, but feels nothing. He exists in and for himself, and though he still may have a family, one can at least say that he has not got a fatherland." He also felt that this sense of individualism was the opposite of patriotism. That patriotism, you know, was, mm-hmm. or a sense of a fatherland, had to do with wishing for the welfare of the whole, rather than individuals.
Right.
And I think, as we see today with the greatest inequality in the distribution of wealth since the 1920s, where the poor get poorer and the rich get richer, de Tocqueville's observations of hundreds of years ago is accurate today.
Those are very. It's very interesting that he could make those observations so early in the history of our country.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what came from kind of collecting this research was the very clear outcome that the researchers concluded that social scientists couldn't possibly pick a worse population to draw any kind of broad generalizations about humanity from than those of us in the West. We're you know, a fraction of the Earth's population, and we're outliers, and yet this has been the group of people that we have been using for decades to try to speculate and best understand about what we call human nature. So a couple of the findings that I think are really important for us to consider and to talk about, I'm going to read a quote from the research: "Western mind is the most self-aggrandizing and egotistical on the planet. We are more likely to promote ourselves as individuals," just what you were saying, "versus advancing as a group. Weird mind is also more analytic. We possess the tendency to telescope in on an object of interest rather than to understand that object in the context of what is around it."
And by weird, he's referring specifically to America, even though the European mind would have a tendency in that direction, say, compared to traditional societies. You know, I've lived in, for years, lived and worked for 6 years in India and Nepal, and this research to me is a no-brainer. It was so obvious. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in India for 2 years, and then I did research and worked for Peace Corps in Nepal for 4 years, and I was pretty much living at the village level. In fact, most of the time I was living in a village. And I had to adjust to what was going on there. And it was really clear that I was weird in more ways than one. But even though in all those years, I feel I barely scratched the surface of trying to understand the deeper issues, I got an aspect. You could see the behaviors more easily than the worldview. The worldview takes a lot. You have to speak the language. You have to talk to people. I mean, let's take Tlingit society. You know, we can see the externalities. We can see the things outside. But in terms of the worldview, you know, I notice this clinically. I might have somebody coming in, a Native Alaskan person, and but, you know, it could also be a Filipino person. They let's just say they describe a problem of what are they going to do. They're an adult, and their adult alcoholic brother, let's say, or impaired brother, should they give him money? What should they do? Should they house him? And so I might rattle off all sorts of Western stuff about codependency and this and that. And am I really talking to their need? Their need is possibly, I am a member of this family. And I remember long ago one individual who was really making it in higher education. And I kind of said, well, you know, it's really important for you to think of yourself. You might have to drop out of college if you do this. And, I mean, I was not speaking from the same worldview at all. Have you run into anything like this clinically?
Absolutely, and I think that I think you're hitting right on the importance of this. Is that those of us trained in Western culture, trained in Western cultural institutions
and psychology
to do psychotherapy, we're coming from a perspective that involves a set of blinders, and it's a set of blinders that blinds us to many of the deepest and most important aspects of people in other cultures that we may be trying to serve. That piece, I can look back now over my work in hospice over the years and many, many areas of social work and human service work, and realized how many times my worldview really blinded from me, as you were saying, from being able to really see what was the critical thing here. What would somebody really need? And very often it was that piece between individuality, between kind of that sacred notion that we in the United States are individuals first, last, and always, versus the connections to a group of people and the benefit to everybody in that group and our responsibilities to everyone in that group. And I think this is a huge issue, and you know, as we go further, I think there's some more research that will touch on this.
Oh, good.
So one of the pieces that that I think they came away from this is that a significant finding is that, you know, if human cognition, if our way of thinking is shaped by cultural ideas and behavior, we can't study it without taking into account what those ideas are and what those behaviors are and how they're different from place to place, that we don't all grow up in boxes, in cities, in surrounded by Western institutions. And what this has done is essentially it has kind of shaken the foundations of a lot of Western research. Now they're realizing, people who have come to some of the presentations that this group of researchers have provided, have come forward, somebody who is doing work on brain imaging, and saying, we're making the same mistake. We're doing all our imaging studies on people from Western societies. We have to change how we're approaching this. So
you mean that's assuming all brains are alike?
And that people are going to respond to the same stimuli, the same situation, in the same way, versus how each of our brains becomes wired by culture to respond.
Exactly. I mean, now with our knowledge of neuroplasticity, that there is not a nature-nurture divide, that our actual gene expression that depends on the environment, the actual brain that is being neuroimaged could be very different for an Amazonian subsistence hunter compared to a kid growing up at going to Montessori in Juneau.
Right.
It's a whole, it could be right. a very, very different brain.
Right.
Would this be a good point, a good spot to take a music break?
Sure.
Does that work for you?
Absolutely.
Okay. This is Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and I'm here with Gary Weglars, and we are talking about is there truly a human nature? Are all brains alike? Do all people have the same worldview? And the research that Gary's citing was conducted by three University of British Columbia scientists, an anthropologist, a psychologist, and the third field
might be
sociology,
yeah.
I'm not sure. But this is from University of British Columbia, and it was published, the research was published in an academic peer-reviewed journal and was really well received. And my husband's an anthropologist, and I know when I told him about this, he also said, well, yeah. Gary, you wanted to say something?
I want to leave us with a quote here.
Oh, good.
And this is because I think it sums up the research quite well. It says, you know, the growing body of cross-cultural research suggested that the mind's capacity to mold itself to culture and environment was far greater than had been assumed. And I love this part. The most interesting thing about cultures may not be the observable things they do, the rituals, the eating preferences, codes of behavior and the like, but in the way they mold our most fundamental conscious and unconscious thinking and perception.
Perfect. Perfect. And that's what we're going to be talking about when we come back. We're going to listen to some great music that my wonderful volunteer technicians, Dolly and John Kramers, have chosen, and they chose the music every month for this program, and they have good taste in music, so I'm going to let them keep doing it. So we'll be right back to talk more about this with Gary Weglars.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm here in the studio, live, with Gary Weglars, a clinician in private practice, as well as working for Juno Hospice. We've been talking the last half hour about how cross-cultural differences really impact worldview and how Western psychology has used for its experimentation subjects from a very narrow range of human beings, specifically the majority of whom are American sophomores in college who take psychology or social science classes. There goes. See, we haven't even been testing, Gary, we haven't even been testing the engineering students. They probably have a different way of seeing things. So what we're going to talk about during the remaining part of the show, we're going to continue on this topic, but then we're also going to take a look at, we're going to explore a related topic, how and why we humans experience empathy and compassion. In other words, how our mirror neurons operate. Okay, so Gary, let's continue talking about this cross-cultural bias in Western psychology.
Okay, I think one of the things that I think is most important about these differences, because it's a profound difference, and you were talking about it in some of your quotes from de Tocqueville, is the idea of holistic thinking versus analytic thinking. Holistic thinking in terms of seeing the whole picture, seeing the interrelationship of things, versus analytic thinking, which tends to be the case in Western society, where we take something out of the setting that it exists in, and we examine it in that setting in an attempt to understand it, and then plug it back into the system without necessarily having any better understanding of how it functions within the system. One example that sticks with me from my time in Barrow that a friend just shared was the idea of how maybe a Native Alaska person versus myself as a white man might look at a flower in a field. And I come from the background where, you know, what did our biologists do, you know, or like an Audubon, we pick the flower, we count the number of petals on the flower, we measure the length of the stamens and the stem, how many leaves it has, you know, we do wonderful diagrams that just kind of take this flower totally apart. We have no idea how the flower functions in that field in relation to the wind and the rain and the bees and everything right. else going on, versus a holistic way of thinking which actually sees the flower in relationship to everything else in its environment. And I can't help but thinking that this analytic way of looking at the world, of kind of taking the world apart, maybe part of why we have such a hard time in the West grappling with the huge problems that are facing us. If we take, say, climate change, for example, I'll read an article one day that will talk about increasing CO2 levels, and there'll be kind of the pro and con of whether that can be, you know, considered really an evidence of climate change. And then there'll be another article, a separate article, that'll be about shrinking ice caps. And then a third one about increasing storm intensity and increasing drought, lengthening forest fire seasons, all different separate articles. And it seems to me that we have a very difficult time pulling these things together, looking at our planet as a whole, and the things that are happening on it in relationship to each other.
Well,
and,
okay, just one of my favorite games is to see an article in the newspaper, like this morning's newspaper, Juno Empire, and it's talking about the eroding shoreline in Alaskan villages, Native Alaskan villages. Right next to it is an article about the increase in, what was it, methane coming out. And there's no link up. Now we all know that the eroding, we're losing Alaskan village shorelines because of climate change and sea rising and increased storms, but it's not mentioned. With the latest typhoon in the Philippines, the people in the Philippines get it, as I understand it, the delegate, the government delegate to the Conference on Climate Change, I think it was in Poland this past month, begged the wealthy nations to please cut emissions on CO2, to cooperate. And in fact, he cried about this because he knew that the typhoon was completely related to climate change. And I even understand he went on a fast. So they link it up. They don't think they're it's some odd thing. It's all connected. All these newspaper articles on the same page are connected. But, you know, also, I was just thinking of, have you ever heard of Michael Pollan? Michael,
sure.
Oh, good. Well, remember, he wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma, and I just think he's an amazing writer on food and nutrition. He really critiqued the science of nutrition for taking out, atomizing vitamins and minerals out of food, and then we take supplements. And he said what nutritional science is missing is that these all have to work together. It's the interactions
right.
between the whole.
Right.
And we even have a name for that study. It's called systems theory. And I remember back in graduate school coming upon systems theory and going, wow, that's it. So we had to kind of reinvent the wheel, so to speak, and get into systems theory.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think what I find fascinating about this whole realm of research is I think what we're seeing is that Western science is finally catching up with indigenous thought around the world and realizing that we have to be able to think in holistic ways. And this isn't to say, you know, one way is the best way to think and the other way isn't as good. It's how can we think, how can we move back and forth in terms of ways of understanding and seeing things. And at this point, it seems like our focus on analytic thinking actually creates a barrier for us in terms of really being able to understand our place in the world and how our environment is being impacted, you know, by our human endeavors, which I think is a hugely serious issue for us.
And the karma of our behaviors is coming back to haunt us, and it's pretty terrifying if you read the methane article and what's going on there.
You know, thinking it just in terms of notions of the collective good and ideas of original ideas, of thinking seven generations ahead, I find incredible wisdom in that. That's a very powerful notion of how connected we are, not only to each other, but to the planet.
Yes, yes. And, Gary, what I would like to begin to explore tonight, because we'll just have a chance to begin, is this related topic that you are so interested in, and I must say I am too, and that is, what is it, what about mirror neurons and empathy and emotional contagion? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Again, as I was researching a talk for hospice cross-cultural work, I came across material on mirror neurons, which I think I had kind of stumbled on before, but maybe never really tuned into in the same way. And just to tell the audience a little bit about how this was discovered, because it's kind of a fascinating story of how accidentally, you know, really important work can be, or really important discoveries can take place. Research was going on in a laboratory where a monkey's brain had electrodes placed in certain areas, and they were doing this research around being able to see what parts of the monkey's brain would be activated, would kind of light up, be activated, when the monkey would reach for food. And so, you know, they're doing this research and seeing the parts of the brain that are activated. One day, a researcher came into the room and happened to reach for a piece of food, and lo and behold, the monkey's brain in the same areas lit up and was activated watching the researcher
reach for food and pick up food.
This totally happenstance occurrence led to the discovery of mirror neurons. And And it was discovered that we have, in our brains, we have both motor action mirror neurons and mirror neurons related to emotion. And when it comes to the motor functions here, so literally what happens is if I watch you picking up a cup of coffee and sipping from it, the same areas in your brain that are lighting up, doing that action, are lighting up in my brain and being activated watching you do it. Another example of research around this to give you an idea of just how strange at some level that it almost seems. They did some research where they exposed participants to have to smell a really disgusting odor, and they were monitoring their brains with MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, so they could see what areas of the brain were activated by this terrible odor. And then they showed subjects short movie clips that just showed the facial expression of somebody reacting with disgust to an odor. The no odor present, just observing the facial expression on another person's face. And so in one there was the actual smell, and one in the other setting there was only the visual of a person reacting to smell. And the same areas of our brain are activated and come into play in both of those things. Now, this, to me, this is a really profoundly important piece, because what it says is that, I'll read a quote from Dr. Marco Iacoboni, who is an Italian researcher who's been kind of at the center of a lot of this. And this is a quote: "When we see someone else suffering or in pain, mirror neurons help us to read his or her facial expression and actually make us feel the suffering and the pain of the other person. These moments are the foundation of empathy and possibly of morality, a morality that is deeply rooted in our biology." That is a hugely, hugely important concept, I think. The idea that we are literally wired as human beings to be able to experience empathy.
And so that is a question linked up to our look at cross-cultural differences. Are we all wired culturally the same way to experience empathy? Are our mirror neurons, given neuroplasticity, do we have the same mirror neurons across different cultures is really what I'm asking. I mean, we have mirror neurons. They're there. But that's also, I mean, I'm sure much to be explored.
Well, and I think that is the profound question right now. And I think really this research, I think, really challenges the foundations of the kind of Western cultural model that splits each of us from each other. Says I should be concerned about myself, you know, my own success, my own wealth, my own satisfaction in life, but not the welfare of other people. But our own science is telling us that this is not how our brains are wired. We're not wired to ignore other people's suffering and pain, to walk by the homeless person and pretend like they're not there.
You know what, this my mind is going a mile a minute with what you're saying, in because I'm just thinking of the research that shows that once a person reaches what we would call middle class, they have a house, they have a job, they have a car, you know, they have enough, that there's no greater happiness from any further accumulation of wealth. And then I'm thinking the direction that we're going, particularly in this country, and the suffering. Are you happier driving your Lexus and driving into your gated community than if you lived in a place like Juneau, which is, I'm not saying there of course is vast differences in wealth, but we're all in the same pot. We all go to the same schools, pretty much. We all shop at the same stores, despite the inequality. And, you know, do I need my own private jet? So it's just really interesting how a culture can take an idea that, you know, everybody, as the Dalai Lama says, everybody wants to be happy. And then I would go on to say, but we're often looking for it in all the wrong places.
I think that's a wonderful observation, and I think your point that the idea that we are somehow separate and individual is just that. It's an idea. It is not something that that our human experience and even our scientific research right now is supporting. Part of this research, I think, connects to the idea of emotional contagion and how emotions then are passed between people. And the definition of this is emotional contagion, the tendency to automatically mimic and synchronize facial expressions, vocalizations, postures, and movements with those of another person, and consequently to converge emotionally. And what we found is as quickly as when in a 20th of a second, in the presence of another person, we can be connecting with their emotional state. And an interesting just a brief story here I'll share around this, because I think it illustrates this point in a powerful way. Gabor Mate is a wonderful physician who works has worked with a needle exchange program working with homeless and addicted, drug addicted people in Vancouver, British Columbia. And he's written some wonderful books, and I've heard him speak, and he tells this story about being born in Budapest, Hungary. And his mother actually told him this story. He was an infant at the time. And his mother explained that she was caring for him in their apartment in Budapest, and the German army, the Nazis, this is during World War II, came to the outskirts of town. And so the German army is preparing to move into Budapest. And little baby Gabor starts crying, and mom can't get him to stop crying. He's crying and he's crying, and finally... His mother told him, so she said, finally, I called the doctor, and I said, you know, I don't know what to do. I can't get my baby to stop crying. And the doctor's response was, all the Jewish babies are crying. Now, you think about that for a minute. You think about infants, babies, have no knowledge of Nazis, no knowledge of war. All they can respond to is what's going on within the being and the brain and heart of mom, dad,
yes,
the people in that home.
Yeah.
And so they're obviously feeling and picking up the emotional contagion, the terror of what's coming next.
And so what you're saying is they were picking it up in the parent. And even though the parents were hiding it or not, and the child is pre-verbal,
right,
all the Jewish
right.
babies are crying because their parents are so scared.
Exactly. And you know, when you think about this same effect, you know, reading about the boarding schools in Native Alaska, and how at night one child would start crying, and then another, and before you knew it, an entire room of children, of grade school children, are weeping and crying themselves to sleep night after night. That's this emotional contagion effect.
You know, have you seen that stunning psychology test about the flat face aspect
yes.
of the mother? It talk about emotional contagion. It's a classic that's taught to
yep.
Early. I used to teach child development at UAS, and we'd show this. So a mother sitting with her infant, and, you know, maybe the child is one. And the mother's smiling and responding to the infant. And then the infant's responding to the mother, and it's a happy Madonna child sort of scenario. And then the mother is instructed to have an absolutely flat affect, flat face, no expression, and just to start that. So then the baby's sitting there, and the mother's just basically looking depressed, no emotion on her face. And the baby then starts to try to get the mother to respond. And the baby makes all sorts of moves to get the mother to respond. And the mother doesn't respond. And then the baby gets fussy. And eventually the baby starts sobbing. And you can see this.
Yes.
What happens? The emotional contagion. The baby just picked up completely this depressed affect of the mother. Oh, yeah.
It's just painful to watch.
Yeah, it is very painful to watch.
Yeah. And so, you know, if we think about, you know, what does this mean in terms of at a societal level? You know, and so I find myself thinking, well, what does it mean for us since 9/11, when we spent a number of years where you couldn't go to an airport without being bombarded with, we're at threat level orange, you know, we're at threat level orange.
Yes.
So this constant,
thank God that's
this constant
over.
Fear. And now we have come to accept that it's routine that we, you know, we going in, a TSA agent will, you know, take our ID and our ticket and look us with kind of that flat affect in our eyes.
And don't make any jokes.
And no, and the question, you know, that is on that face is, can I trust you? You know, can I? So we have, you know, brought into the culture this kind of communication that's going on, which is, you know, essentially supporting the idea that we can't trust each other, you know, that any of us could be this very dangerous person. And, you know, and I have to believe this has a significant kind of impact on us
psychologically.
Culturally.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't that many years ago that you didn't walk into a scanner, lift your arms, and then get patted down. This is a different way of being with each other.
And or the federal building or so many other places with high security. We need to say goodbye to our listening audience. Our time is up. Do you have any last words? Did you have something you wanted to say, Gary, before I wind up?
Oh, yes. I'm gonna leave with a quote from Desmond Tutu.
Lovely.
Okay. And he talks about an idea called Ubuntu in African tribal philosophy. He says a person with Ubuntu has a proper self-assurance that comes from knowing that he or she belongs in a greater whole and is diminished when others are humiliated or diminished. And he says, the truth of who we are is that we are because we belong. So the question I have for all of us is, we might ask ourselves in the West here, what do we belong to? What do we belong to? And if our natural feelings of empathy and concern for the suffering of others are at fundamental odds with our own cultural beliefs, then what might that realization mean to us?
That's a wonderful note on which to end. And I would like to thank you, Gary, for coming tonight. This was wonderful, wonderful information you've shared with us. And I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning into K2. I'll be hosting another program on Monday evening, January 2nd at 7 p.m., where I'll be in conversation with Dr. Lauren Hine, a scientist activist from Juneau who's working to reduce the toxic chemicals in our food as well as our environment. So this is good work because she cares about the whole. And so join us on Monday, January 2nd to learn more about what is being done to make our food, water, and air safer and how we can limit our own exposure to toxins. But before we sign off, thanks to John and Dolly Kramers here tonight who so beautifully multitask throughout our show. Good night.